Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Solari Report Dr. Joseph Farrell to talk about productivity. Our theme for the second quarter wrap-up was productivity, and the PDF is published. It's up on the website. The hard copies are mailing to those of you who've ordered them. You'll receive them. If you don't receive them this week, you'll receive them next week. And Dr. Farrell was nice enough when I had the opportunity to see him last month. We chatted, and he, God bless him, he always understands, you know, what's important. And he agreed that he would come on and have a little discussion with me about the second quarter wrap-up productivity issues. So, Joseph, welcome to the Solari Report, and thank you so much for joining me for this conversation.
Well, thanks for having me back, Catherine. Yeah, we had quite a long discussion, as I recall, about how to strategize our way out of this. So, yeah.
Well, it's terrible. I mean, it's terrible.
It's nuts.
Right. It's completely nuts. And so I thought if we could unpack the nuts for all the different constituencies dealing with this, that maybe we could start to get some productive action, get productivity moving in the right way. Before we start, I just want to mention that anybody who wants to talk to us about productivity or anything can come and be with both you and me. We're converging on Tulsa, coming from all four directions onto Tulsa on October 15th for dinner. It's the launch party for something I'm very excited about, the Grand Virtual Pipe Organ Crowdfund.
I have to thank you again.
Well, all of your fans are going to make sure that you get a virtual pipe organ, and we can't wait to see the productivity that flows from that.
Well, I've got it. Listen, I've said many times, I have not played an organ in over 30 years on a steady basis. I probably couldn't play chopsticks right now, but I did something that's unusual. I made up a practice list of all the old pieces that I used to play to try and get back under my fingers and feet. So,
how many tracks will you have to think in? 24, 26?
On a pipe organ, standard organ music usually has anywhere from 6 to 8 voices. So in other words, you're usually dealing with 8 lines of music. When you get to the French symphonic school of organ playing, they do, on top of that, they have you doing things like playing on 2 manuals at the same time with 1 hand, double pedaling, you know, using both feet at the same time. And
So
things begin to mushroom in the 19th century. But yeah, it's you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because people have asked me why I place so much emphasis on music and listening to the composers of those eras. And in all honesty, Catherine, I credit at least my personal ability to connect so many dots to having grown up playing that instrument. Because,
yes,
you know, it's not an instrument that you don't want to play if you can't multitask.
I couldn't agree more. So we're excited. So anybody who wants to come talk with us and have a blast, we're going to be at the Irish Pub in Tulsa. You can learn more about it at Solari.com or Giza Death Star, and get tickets at Solari.com. And so remember, October 15th, 7 to 11 p.m., dinner at the Irish Pub, and great times for all. Okay, so productivity. One of the things that inspired me to write on productivity, there was two things. One is the German finance minister in February in Shanghai at the G20 meeting saying that essentially the debt-financed growth model is over, and there are no reforms that aren't, there are no shortcuts that aren't real reforms.
Right. And
essentially what he was saying, Joseph, is, we can't plaster things over with government money anymore, whether it's, you know, printing fiat currency or issuing more government debt. We have to really get back to fundamental economic productivity. And right after that, we see Alan Greenspan, my vote for number one evildoer of the financial system of the last 20 years, coming out and saying that productivity growth was not growing. And as a result, we weren't going to be able to meet our pension fund obligations, as if the financial coup d'etat that he engineered with 40 trillion missing had nothing to do with that.
To do with it, exactly, exactly. Right. Well, Schäuble is interesting to me because, you know, this is the one major finance minister from a G20 country. And again, we need to remember, folks, that Germany's economy, for such a small population base, is enormous.
Right.
I think it ranks 4 or 5 in the world, and this is after the United States and China and India, Japan, you know, countries with a considerably larger population base. So that old strategic problem that we've had, you know, with Germany prior to World War I is now magnified. It's on steroids.
Right.
So this is a huge economy. It's an export-driven economy. And for him to come out and say this means that, as far as I'm concerned, I'm on board with you. It means that the old financial system of government debt, hidden finance, suspension of the rule of law, all of this covert apparatus that they've built up to rig markets and securities markets, commodities markets, just about every market that you can think of, that day is over. What's really interesting is when Schäuble made that remark, I don't recall that he proposed any solutions. He didn't come out with any long-term strategy to answer the problem of productivity, which is really, as you pointed out in that excellent study that I just finished reading today, that's the major problem that everybody
right.
has. You know, how do we produce our way out of this? And, you know, I think that's probably what we're here to explore today is really kind of put a record to our conversations that we had the last time you passed through, because we talked all day about all of that.
Let me just go through quickly a couple
sure.
of definitions, because labor productivity is simply the economic output of labor divided by hours. So you're talking
right.
about, you know, how much GMP essentially are you getting per hour? I'm grossly oversimplifying. But and one of the things I defined in what I wrote is there's something bigger called human productivity, which is,
right.
you know, are we productive outside of work hours? Now, there's some labor that is not technically paid labor that's included in the labor statistics, but I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of our time outside of the time that we're working. And the reality is, you know, from everything I can see in the developed world, the productivity of our time outside of work is going down.
Yes.
So
yes.
an enormous amount of time is being lost or wasted. So I define the two as labor productivity and then human productivity being all productivity, whether it's at the workplace or outside the workplace. And I think one of the things I feel, Joseph, is labor productivity has been going up, but human productivity has not. In
right.
fact, it's been going down in many places, certainly I think in the United States. And that's part of the tension here is, you know, are we just trying to make corporations more efficient, or are we trying to respect human time broadly?
Well, yeah, this is a two-track problem, the way you framed it, and I have to agree with you. On the one hand, we've got, you know, we just saw this week the merger between Bayer and Monsanto, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, as I heard that news, I'm thinking, oh my word, you know, they're going.
That's going to be in our aspirin.
Yeah, you know, exactly. You know, they're going after a cartel arrangement to literally control the pharmaceutical industry and hence
right.
healthcare, as you've pointed out many times. They're going after the food supply, and in addition to this, you know, Monsanto recently bought Blackwater, I think it was back in 2013. So, you know,
right.
we're looking at an old component of IG Farben, we're looking at Monsanto with its wonderful track record. And we're looking at a private mercenary force behind all of this, you know. So I'm,
right.
you know, what could possibly go wrong here? You know? So the centralization move continues, but the problem here is it goes directly to productivity, and in this case, I think a bit of both kinds, both labor productivity
right.
and human productivity, because the GMO solution to agribusiness, to the human food supply, is a short to mid-term solution that ultimately is going to break down. Because
right.
as you've pointed out many times on the website, this is poisoning the food supply. It is crippling pollinators, the bee population and hummingbirds and things like that cross-pollinate the crops. And ultimately, you know, there's been University of Iowa studies, I've blogged about this on my own site, that have pointed out that over the long term, actual agricultural productivity of GMO fields versus natural heirloom seed planted crops declines, because the cost of maintaining these GMO fields keeps rising and rising and rising. And in addition to this, the problem of those rising costs is that Mother Nature adapts faster than genetic engineers can engineer their GMO crops. So in other words, you know, the cost is going up, the production's going down. So the centralization model in just that one area alone is not working. But on the other hand, what this has done is it's taking the family farm. You know, I grew up in South Dakota around family farms, and it was very clear that on these farms back then, there was obviously the labor productivity, but these farmers would do other things to increase their productivity, and that fell in what you're calling human productivity. They'd go out, they'd sell their produce, and so on and so forth. So this is missing from the models of these people. You know, I literally sat here reading your brochure that you're sending out this afternoon, and I was thinking, my word, this is not only true, but it's true in another way I think we have to look at. We're looking at, and we've discussed this many times, we're looking at new technologies that are coming online, 3D printing, distributed manufacturing, and so on and so forth, that are putting people out of work as they are increasing the efficiency of production. So the problem is we've now got a huge human labor pool that is basically idle, and they are not doing anything by way of human productivity. And I think one of the solutions, and I'm proposing this as a very serious solution in the human productivity sphere, is this is a perfect outlet to create with that disenfranchised labor pool. This is a perfect outlet now for that population to move into other types of human productivity. And I'm thinking specifically of the arts, because robots and 3D printers cannot produce stuff like that. And this is an area where people can expand their human productivity at a local level.
Right.
So I, you know, this to me, you know, and I'm thinking quite frankly in terms of, you know, starting up small film companies, starting up little media ventures, going out and playing your music in a coffee shop and throwing your hat down on the floor, you know, I'm literally thinking in those terms. Because there's a vast, huge, untapped reservoir now of human creativity in these areas. So I think, you know, people need to really wrap their heads around this and understand that this is in a certain sense a golden sent opportunity for them to explore, you know, dreams, explore what they wanted to do in those types of terms. They don't have to wait for a corporation to come along and give them a job, in other words, is what I'm saying. The real problem that people are going to have is they're going to have to monetize that productivity in some way. They're going to have to figure out a way to make money off of it. And, you know, I fully expect human ingenuity will solve the problem if people just realize that, hey, we need to get out there and start doing this.
Well, technology, Joseph, should benefit decentralization. And in fact, if you look at what happened over the last 20 years, it's really been government enforcement and regulation that stopped that.
Yep,
and,
exactly.
It stopped that in a way which has destroyed the low-cost performer and given the market to a higher-cost performer, and that's really government intervention.
Yes.
And without government debt to subsidize that, that can't last.
Well, yes, and there's another aspect of this government interference with what you're talking about, and that's with the new trade so-called free trade agreements with copyright and the way that corporations are now strategizing the use of copyright to shut down free speech. But, you know, the ultimate result of what they're trying to do is going to choke even the creativity that they themselves require and survive on in order to increase their own corporate bottom line. I have a blog coming up on my website about this copyright issue. And the bottom line here, again, is this is just another mechanism that, they're throwing out there to interfere with the growth of human creativity, analysis, critical thought, and so on and so forth. And again, that's an area that has to be monetized. That's the whole point of copyright law, is to protect people doing that and to protect the discourse. It's not meant as a mechanism to shut it down. So, you know, again, people have to start pushing back against these corporations and precisely against this type of government intervention that's slanted toward the corporation and the centralized solution. Because you and I both know centralized solutions in managements of huge economies simply don't work.
They don't work.
Economies are too complex for it.
Yeah, you shut down markets, you shut down productivity. Well, let me step back because I wanted to go back and go a little bit along the outline that I had in the productivity section. Mm-hmm. I kept trying to write this, Joseph, and I would get so upset that I literally couldn't write until I wrote the second section, which is called The Absurdity of Discussing Productivity, Prosperity, and the Popsicle Index.
Yes.
Because when you look at what's going on, what is going on is so completely insane. Mm-hmm. And meantime, the whole country is pretending it's not happening.
Right.
That I just had to get that cleared. I just had to say, you know something? Look at what's happening. You know, we are having organic materials drop from the sky, which are changing, you know, us at a molecular and DNA level. Mm-hmm. We're having invisible weaponry and surveillance used on the general population.
Yes.
We're having entrainment and mind control. We're being poisoned with pesticides and the spraying. Now, if you look at what's going on with vaccines, you know, we have the CDC putting in a rule saying that they can basically, you know, grab any human being on the theory that they might have been infected and then shoot them up with poisons. I mean, if you go, I put a list in the productivity section, so I won't bore everybody by repeating it. But if you look at what's going on, I don't even have a word for it because it's so nuts.
Yes, it is beyond insanity. It is, you know, I don't mind qualifying it as diabolical, because ultimately this is an anti-human, inhuman agenda that they're pursuing, and that agenda in itself again stifles human creativity and therefore stifles human productivity.
Right.
So, you know, I'm with you. In fact, that section, I spent the most time this afternoon. That's really the keystone in the arch of what you're saying in that booklet, is that section. Because you cannot have a functioning economic system along the model that has developed with such huge corruption endemic in the system. And again, the solution isn't trying to fight the system at the centralized level. The solution is to combat it by decentralizing and concentrating the efforts locally, and you've pointed that out over and over again in that mailing.
But I feel like saying to any member of the establishment who says, what can we do about productivity growth, mm-hmm. you know, slowing, I could say you could stop destroying productivity.
Exactly.
Just make a list of the 4,522 things you are doing to destroy productivity and just start stopping doing them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. it's really that simple. And, you know, again,
I know.
You know, it's very interesting that you mentioned stopping the things that you're doing, because I have a blog coming up about this as part of that blog on copyright. An Indian court in India.
Oh, isn't this fascinating?
Just shut down an attempt of a corporation to throttle a school that was copying textbooks that it needed. And an Indian court just shut that down. And good for them, because,
right,
you know, the problem here is that as far as I can tell and as far as I'm concerned, copyright protection, patents, and so on, are there not to protect the corporation. They're there to protect creativity. They're there to allow people to monetize their creations, but that does not extend to the right to shut down the discussion about what they have put out there, either in terms of artistic works or in terms of patents and so on and so forth. That discussion has to continue because it's out of that discussion right. that creativity comes. Right. So, you know, kudos to the Indian court for taking the decision that it did.
Well, you know, one of the things I realized, one insight I had, because I work a lot with the construct of a return on investment to taxpayers, one of the things I discovered during the 90s is return on investment to shareholders is being made more positive by making the return to the taxpayers negative.
Right.
So in an economy, you have a private economy, then you have a government economy, and the government money is being used to pump up the stocks
yep.
in a way that is terribly wasteful to the taxpayers. So the example I used in the online book I wrote was the fact that the average taxpayer worked their whole life to generate $100,000, which was enough to pay for 2/3 of 1 year of
yep.
the cost of putting, you know, a nonviolent criminal in prison.
Yep.
And so you were watching taxpayers work their whole lives to finance, you know, nonviolent people who'd sold marijuana going to prison in
yes.
ways that pumped up the prison stocks. But it was, you know, it was insane given the other ways you have of enforcing in that situation.
I think there's two points here I want to add to that. And the first is just, I think, by way of clarification, you're not talking about deregulation.
No.
When you're talking, no, you're not talking about that. And I think this is where most people in the public at large, particularly in the financial sector, have become locked into this regulation, non-regulation dialectic. And that's not what we're talking about. First of all, but since you've mentioned private prisons and marijuana, I used to know somebody for many years that had a prescription for medical marijuana, and he had this prescription to help him deal with the pain that he was dealing with, a terminal illness, and with his appetite, all right? And these medical marijuana prescriptions, Marinol basically is the drug, would come in these little bottles of 30 pills of Marinol extract from marijuana. That little bottle, a 1 month prescription at that time, cost $1,700.
Jesus.
When a $50 bag of marijuana would have done the same trick. Now, this is, add to this the cost of people being thrown into these prisons and maintained, you know, at tremendous cost to the taxpayer, but tremendous bottom line profits for the people lucky enough to own stock in these private prisons, and you get the picture. This
right.
is an upside down economy. It's an economy that is organized only for the benefit of the very few, and ultimately those kinds of economies collapse, and that's what we're seeing. And the only solution to it is, as you say, to get productivity back up in ways that benefit people locally, your popsicle
right.
index, as you call
it. One of the things I realized as I was working on this is that if a system is, when you listen a little bit to proposals to increase productivity,
mm-hmm.
they're trying to make a negative on return on investment system more efficient, which of course just makes the return more negative.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I realized, this explains why people are voting for Donald Trump. In other words,
yes.
if a system is a negative return on investment and you've taken many actions to try and turn it positive and you can't, what you finally realize is let's just blow it up. Because if it blows up, at least that's positive.
Yeah, well, the other thing that I think people have to understand, too, about the Trump phenomenon and how economics and finance play into all of this is that, you know, it's not just the fact that the system isn't working in terms of a negative return on investments financially. It's the same thing politically. People
right.
invest in the political system, and then they're not getting anything out of it. In other words, the paradigm is breaking down that badly. And Schäuble,
right.
you know, the German finance minister, has put his finger on it. But, he's not offering any solutions. He knows, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that he knows that he has to take the approach that you've been advocating. But he can't come out and say that because, of course, he's part of the establishment crowd.
Right.
So, you know, this whole thing is overdue, and we've discussed our strategies about dealing with things locally. One of the things that we also need to look at then is how do we solve the negative return on political investment? You go out and vote, and you've made an investment in a certain sense in the system. So how do you get a positive return on your investment for your vote? And I think increasingly, Catherine, particularly in the United States, I can't speak so much for Australia or Canada or places like that, but I think the solution will be similar there. And that is, in this country, I think every state now, that particularly states that have been run roughshod over by the federal government, every state should now appoint a special district attorney to review any the slightest infringement of their state sovereignty. They need to appoint 14th Amendment prosecutors to challenge any federal mandate that the state cannot meet.
That's an excellent idea. Just bollocks the feds up in court from now until
cows
come
home.
Yeah.
Just, you know, whether Hillary gets in there and packs the court with a bunch of progressives or not, just tie them up in so much litigation that the federal government cannot move forward with all of these programs that really are stifling the economy. You know, I'm convinced, and we've talked about this, I'm convinced that Trump himself represents a segment of the deep state that, because of Obamacare and some other things that have happened in this country with domestic and foreign policy since 9/11, that he represents a faction whose bottom line has been hit by the dwindling amount of discretionary income in the hands of the middle class.
Right.
So, you know, his business is casinos and development and so on, and people, you know, I know people in Vegas that are telling me it's like a ghost town now compared to the way it was just a few years ago. So, you know, with the declining discretionary income, you're hitting precisely the areas of leisure where human productivity is important, where creativity in the arts or whatever is important. So yeah, I'm with you. If he gets in there, just blow up the system. It can't be as bad as what we're seeing now.
So I had the next section I had in the productivity theme was the establishment view.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that surprised me is, as I listen to different presentations by the establishment or people in the establishment, I'm really struck by a couple things. And one is that they really don't understand the issue.
No.
They really don't have a framework for what's going on, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write this. And if you look at, you know, obviously their focus is more on labor productivity because that's where you can get statistics. But if you look at labor productivity, there's a couple things I wanted to point out. One is that in the United States, labor productivity has continued to grow from the 70s on, but hourly compensation has been essentially flatlined from the 70s on, which meant essentially all of the growth in productivity went to the investors or into the back door.
Yes.
Labor didn't get any of them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And right. My question to you is, why didn't labor give up earlier?
Well, again, you know, I think the problem with American politics is that people have been locked into a dialectic between, you know, if you vote Democratic, you're supporting labor, and the facts are now out of the bag. You know, if you vote with that party, you're voting for Wall Street. And the same with the Republicans up until the Trump phenomenon. So that's been the huge revolution, I think, a positive one that we can at least look at in terms of the Trump phenomenon and realize that he has completely changed this whole paradigm. But yeah, I think the other problem here is you had the whole Reagan era and its disastrous effect on labor. Particularly organized labor. But I think the solution there, again, Catherine, is that people have to get out of their...
Decentralized,
precisely. You know, their big union is no longer going to protect them. because they're bought and paid for. So they have to start organizing again on a local, regional, state level.
Right. A second thing that I'm hearing from multiple directions, including the McKinsey study, which is a very good one that I cite in the theme, and that is that if you look at per capita incomes, we're watching convergence of Asia with the developed world, but it's an Asian phenomenon. It's not the emerging markets. Productivity growth in most of the emerging markets continues to be very slow. So
yeah, I read that, and again, it's to me, Catherine, the solution here is not to put in these new free trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the terrible Investment Trade Act, that they've been trying to ram down Europe's throat. The solution is not more centralization in the hands of the corporations. We have to get back on a global basis to fundamental law.
Right.
And the fundamental law is private property is private property. This is the basis of everything. And the corporations, through their mercantilist policies, have been running roughshod over this. So
right.
That's why I'm very encouraged, in terms of the context of the Kinsey report, this is why I'm very, very encouraged about this recent decision in the Indian court about copyright. They just put a halt to this. I'm encouraged by that, Catherine, because India, to a certain extent, has its laws derived from the same pool of legal tradition as most of the rest of the West, and particularly the English-speaking world. So I hope that will establish some sort of precedent in the courts of other countries that have similar jurisprudence history. Because it needs to be done. It needs to be asserted. We have to restore the conversation that the corporations are trying to stamp out. Otherwise, if they're successful, the bottom line here, Catherine, is if they're successful, labor productivity, which is what the establishment is focused on, will come to a screeching halt.
And well, it's interesting because it was India that really, I think, if we look back 100 years from now, stopped GMOs. Now, it cost the lives of over 200,000 farmers. It was a brutal, cost. It was sort of the World War I of seed. Anyway.
Yes.
And the one other thing I wanted to bring up was the fact, and I think this is very important, the reason the productivity conversation gets to be very important right now is what the establishment is saying is, productivity is very low in government, education, and healthcare, and that's where we can get increases in productivity. Now, if you look at why the productivity is low, it's because those areas have been used to subsidize all these corporate areas.
Yes,
and so,
exactly.
Yes, you can increase productivity by stopping the subsidy, but that's not the conclusion that's being promoted. They're saying, let's make the theft of the subsidy more efficient.
Yes, exactly.
And create monopolies to continue this low productive. Right. And in that effort, what you are going to get is war, and everybody's going to lose. The establishment's not going to win. They're going to lose. The people are not going to win. They're going to lose. This is like a lose-lose. And the only person who's scheduled to get rich on it is Bill Gates, who's already the richest man in America, and Warren Buffett. I think this is one of the reasons they want a woman as president to put a fluffy face on really the demonic nature of what they're up to. And I have to say, from talking to lots of members of the establishment, they really don't understand. They don't have a framework to see clearly what is going on here. They really don't. And so it's very important to me to communicate to them, look, all these areas are unproductive because they've been subsidizing, piggy behavior, oink, oink, over here to return to shareholder. And we can make them productive, but the subsidy's got to stop. And that's a much more productive solution. Stopping that subsidy is a much more productive solution than turning the healthcare and education system into a demonic mess.
Well, and we need to understand, particularly when we're talking about productivity in education, Corporations measure productivity by, you know, of course, their profits and how efficiently they're able to increase their profit margin. But this is not what productivity in education really is. Productivity in education is a very qualitative thing, and our attempts to make it quantitative through standardized tests and so on and so forth have fallen flat because, of course, America, as is well known, has one of the most dumbed down populations as a result of this pursuit of corporate profits in the education sphere for the last 130 years. So the problem is people have to understand that productivity is not ultimately a quantifiable phenomenon in terms of the dollars it produces for you. Because if your productivity is based solely on that in education, studies have shown that this whole approach, this computer in the classroom, electronic textbooks, standardized test approach, has actually interfered with productivity in the sense of learning a discipline and being able to apply that discipline in other contexts. This is the exact opposite, in other words, of what they're saying they're about doing. So, yeah, they're simply using education as another means for sucking up money, as you say, oink, oink, from the government trough and producing essentially nothing for the population at large. That's of any benefit to human productivity.
Right.
So it's, yeah, it's a big scam is all it is.
Right. Well, then let's go back to technology. You brought up technology, and I think technology is very important.
Yes.
One is, it's a huge wild card in what happens next.
Right.
But the other thing is if you look at the people, as I pointed out, if you look at the people who've been implementing new technology, one of the most frightening things about the American economy right now is how clueless they are about what's really going on.
Yes.
And people are beginning to notice that we've poured trillions of dollars into Silicon Valley, and it's been very useful to centralize control, but it hasn't contributed much productivity growth.
In fact, it's contributed little.
Right. And so... you know, so there's starting to be questions about, well, wait a minute, you know, how do we use technology? And then the last thing I want to bring up is, which I think is so important, if you say, okay, we're going to use technology to automate, which would technically increase labor productivity, you get into a trap, Joseph. And this is very important. You're one of the few people who understands enough about the economy to understand this. If I automate to increase productivity growth, which I feel very pressured to do if I'm a member of the establishment, I'm going to deflate. And I'm going to deflate just at the time when my debt has never been higher and my need for hidden financial flows and stealing money has never been higher.
Yes.
So if deflation shrinks my balance sheet, how am I going to cover the debt? How am I going to cover the black budget and the hidden system of finance? You know, so just as my secret taxation is growing bigger and bigger, if I deflate and shrink my income and expense and balance sheet as deflation does, I can't hide it anymore. What am I going to do?
Well, you know, it's again, they're putting the cart before the horse because they're throwing a bunch of people out of work who are the very people that have to buy their products.
Right.
You know, we see this in the automobile industry. They've automated to the extent that they're now producing cars that cost as much as a house, while at the same time they're throwing people out of work. So, you know, this is just totally nuts. And I think, again, the solution has to be that people realize, particularly people in the establishment, they have to realize that there is an untapped sphere of human creativity. And I'm going back to my idea about the arts here. If people were able to create things at a local level, put them up on YouTube and monetize it, you know, oh, I just wrote this song and here, you can listen to it for 50 cents or whatever.
Right.
Over time, this is going to start to build up local liquidity, which is what you need when
you think
you
it's
have,
doing it now?
Who?
you know, the people making money on the internet or through YouTube from their music, or?
Well, it's not being done to nearly the extent it should be.
Right.
In other words, what I'm saying is we have a tool now that can be directly accessed to bypass and create local and regional monetized communities of creativity. In other words, you know, Hollywood has basically an iron lock. The television networks basically have an iron lock on the visual media. But now we have the technology that this can be done locally. We don't need to have these big studios in Hollywood anymore pumping out their movies. You can go out and make a decent movie with a video cam and some amateur actors. And what the effect of this will be is it will be deflationary on these big centralized structures, but it will create local liquidity. And this is what's needed, because local liquidity is drying up. You know, Obamacare has done this. Common Core will do it big time. And as a result of that, the labor productivity, they can talk about making that more efficient all they want, but if you don't have people with the money to buy your goods and services, you're stuck.
Well, we just published an overview called Rebuilding a Local Economy, because I wanted to, you know, we've published a tremendous amount about that over the last 10 years, and I wanted to kind of organize it and remind everybody so they can make it easy to find it. But if you look at the rules related to one local currencies, the rules related to local securities and equity financing, both public and private, and the rules related to food and food safety rules, you know, government regulation and enforcement is stopping local economies. It's basically gridlock, blocking and stopping them. And that's in part why the healthcare and education discussion is so important, because two of the most important pieces left at the local level is healthcare and education. And it's really the, you know, the government making it, changing the rules so that Silicon Valley can move in and suck all that up.
Yep,
and
exactly.
It's going to bring things to a head, because the local economy, the people in the local economy, Joseph, know that markets are being prevented. I mean, you just cancel the food safety rules and watch the number of local farms that just spring up, let alone if they can finance with equity locally or crowdfund with equity, you know, locally or regionally. It's just, it will all skyrocket. So I, you know, I'm always saying that the current wealth is 1% of what it could be.
Yes.
And so that flourishing can happen. And it's not just if they change the rules. I think it's, you know, it's a matter of people getting to the point saying it's all bullshit. You know, all these rules are complete bullshit, and we're just going to ignore them and go ahead.
And, I think that's really needed. And you pointed out something also that's very, very important in this mailing that I want to mention in addition to all of this. You pointed out that if healthcare were on a cash and carry basis, we would see an economy turn overnight.
Right.
And the reason I think this is such an important thing that you pointed out is I remember as a kid my parents being able to take me to the doctor and pay for the doctor's visits and for my medications and so on in cash.
Right.
No health insurance and so on and so forth. It's when Lyndon Johnson decided that he wanted to put government into the healthcare business that we saw prices begin to skyrocket, and they haven't stopped since. So, again, I'm with you wholeheartedly here. And the other thing I remember as a kid, precisely, you mentioned food production and so on. And I used to go with my mother to a farmer's market in Sioux Falls. Farmers would bring their produce in, set it up on their stands, and just sell you fresh produce. And you cannot find these things anymore in modern America. You might find occasionally a farmer on a corner with a, you know, selling watermelons or what have you. But I'm with you. People just need to start ignoring the government and just going out and doing it. And, you know, and when the government steps in to shut you down, that's when your special state 14th Amendment prosecutors step in and litigate. Because
I was at the farmer's market in Santa Fe on my way here, and there are a lot of cities that are really trying to promote farmer's markets. But the reality is the more of us who go to the farmer's market, you know, find out where the farmer's market is in your area, if you have one, and go support it, because the more those farmers markets grow, the better off we are. It's got to start.
Yep.
And if you can't go to the farmers markets, find out what restaurants buy from the local farmers and make an effort to patronize those restaurants.
And that's the key here. Make an effort. Right. You know, I've been trying to do this with my own food purchases. You know, I buy organic whenever I can. I try to go to the smaller grocery stores and chains. In other words, I'm not trying to support these big corporations. I don't bank with a big, huge mega bank. I bank with a little local bank and so on and so forth. Because we've got to put as much of our cash flow back into the local community as we can. Because if you put it into these big mega corporations, we know what happens. You've been detailing this for many years, and particularly in the past few years. If you put your money into these big mega corporations, well, you know, half of that money is getting sucked out of the system and being put into this hidden system of finance and used to buy photo ops and fund foundations for more of the same nonsense that's robbing everybody of their wealth. So, you know, it's very important that people start taking responsibility at a local level for their own personal finance and purchases.
Well, I said something in this productivity theme, which I normally don't. You know, for a long time, I've been saying that the dollar is strong and society wasn't going to collapse. But I will tell you this, I don't know what's going to happen next year with the U.S. federal budget, but I think the day of reckoning is going to begin.
Mm-hmm. You too.
And I'm very struck by, essentially, I wrote a blog post called Lockheed Cuts and Runs about Lockheed giving up, you know, spinning out their IT division.
Yep.
So the liability for the $12 trillion missing from the federal government is no longer on Lockheed's balance sheet. It's, you know, on this tiny new company's balance sheet. SAIC created the company to do the same thing. And now Monsanto, I think one of the reasons they're churning over Monsanto, and I don't know exactly how they're going to organize the legal liabilities, but, you know, I think Monsanto's cutting and running from those liabilities. And what that tells me, everybody's getting ready for the end game. And when the smart money gets ready like this, you know, that's when big change is upon us.
Yep.
And you have Greenspan out there basically saying productivity growth is to blame. Now, I did a wonderful Solaria report with Don Cox, who's a pension fund. He's an investment expert, but also knows a great deal about pension funds. And he said after the election, the number one issue is going to be the deficits in the healthcare benefits and the pension systems.
Yep.
You know, and that's really going to come to the fore, whether it's in the federal budgets or in the private pension funds, which ultimately hits the federal pension. And that's going to hit at the same time we're having these huge discussions about healthcare and education. And, you know, the bell has pretty much rung on the unipolar world. And our other big source of subsidy, which is the dollar as reserve currency, is really under threat. We're having to move to a multipolar world. All of these things are going to hit us once. In a funny kind of way, that's what the German finance minister was saying.
Yes, you know? I agree.
Right.
And, you know, we see the signs of this coming with the fact that the renminbi, the Chinese yuan now, is part of the special drawing rights basket of currencies. We've seen this, we've been getting the clues all along that this is coming with Chinese bonds now in the city of London being sold on the Frankfurt Bourse, being sold denominated in yuan and not in dollars.
Right.
So, the multipolar world is coming, and this is the other thing. I think, again, you're absolutely right. The establishment hasn't a clue. They've been operating with the playbook for so long, they cannot think outside of it. So this is the other problem, is to help them transition to this new financial system that is... I don't think anybody really understands how it's going to work,
right?
But they at least need to be aware that it's coming and plan accordingly. And again, for me, the problem is we've got to have liquidity back at a local level.
So I want to put in a plug for some of the members of the establishment. I have watched, you know, one of the members of the establishment that I have on in the Salieri Report is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. So I'll pick on him as an example. Mm-hmm. But I've watched people who have fought within the establishment for the rational course.
Right.
And they've been continuously overturned and overruled by, you know, so the Lawrence Wilkersons of this world have been continuously overruled by the Hillary Clintons of this world.
Right.
And the crowd has supported the Hillary Clintons of this world, by and large. And so we've been in a situation where you have, you know, very solid, capable people in the establishment. Now, some people just said, that's it, I walk out. You know, right. So you have Paul Craig Roberts, you have a David Stockman, and they're on the outside throwing mud balls in. But then you have people like Lawrence Wilkerson, who continue to fight for the rational thing inside the system. And one of the things that concerns me the most, Joseph, is, you know, the crowd, the general population has supported the guy who hands them and writes them the most check, which is generally, in my opinion, organized crime. It's the Bushes or the Clintons.
Right.
And we've reached a point where the general population, how do we get the general population to support the right members of the establishment? Because, you know, not everybody walked out. You know, not everybody played Stockman or Roberts, or not everybody was thrown out like Fitz. You know, we still, I'm not saying we should embrace the establishment whole hog, but we've got to be able to discern from the people who are good at financial fraud to the people who are effective at leading in a multipolar world, because without those people, we're not going to make it. We need to put the right people in charge, and it's not going to be because, you know, a bunch of NGO activists, we're not going to put them in charge. We need the people who understand the systems and are competent at the various, you know, specific functions.
Right.
So how do we, because now everybody's so mad at the establishment, they just want to kill everybody. And that's not a plan. We have to take responsibility for the fact that we're the ones who supported the criminals.
Right. Well, that's again a question of strategy. How do we go about doing this? And quite frankly, I think it's really a case of people like us that have a certain public on our websites and do analysis of geopolitics and so on, of naming the names that and the people and more importantly and perhaps most importantly, the concepts that need to be looked at and addressed. In other words, you know, do we want to support the establishment people like George Soros with their NGOs trying to start wars with Russia, or do we need to support the Colonel Wilkersons?
Right.
And if we're advocating the latter, then we need to spell out the concepts of why we simply can't blow up the establishment and, you know, say that, well, you're a Wall Street banker, you need to be lined up against the wall. You know, the Bernie Sanders approach doesn't work, folks. it just doesn't work. So we need to start doing that. In other words, we need to start making education a formal part of the strategy. We need to start vetting people and putting the names and the concepts out there of what and why this person's good, that person's bad. And not be like, you know, the Paul Craig Roberts. And in a certain sense, you can't blame people like that for getting outside the system and just throwing spitballs at it.
Right.
That's not going to work, you know.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. The thing that would help the most, that would help the legitimate members of the establishment, is if we simply voted in the marketplace with our money. If we just said, okay,
Yes. You know, okay,
Citibank and J.P. Morgan Chase, we don't, you know, we're taking our money and leaving. And that what that means is the bankers who want to do things clean start rising in power within those organizations.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. So that's why I keep saying, who's your farmer, who's your banker, where's your money?
Well, this is why I have this, as I said, I have this blog on copyright coming up, on the relationship between copyright and the right of free speech. Because the two are inextricably intertwined. And, you know, in the blog, I come out and say it's not a matter of just blaming these corporations for pursuing violations of copyright, because the whole point of copyright is to make creativity productive for people that create intellectual content to make it productive for them. What is happening now is there's this dangerous backlash against the whole idea of copyright in certain libertarian circles that I find very alarming, because if you really look at the language that these people are advocating, what they're advocating is a form of Marxism.
Right.
So you're making it unprofitable for people to create, whether you've just written a guitar solo and you want to put up a video of it on YouTube and monetize it to Walt Disney and Time Warner. If you make it unprofitable for people or corporations to do this, on the one hand, then you're achieving the same thing as this corporate overreach in applying copyright law. So we have to understand that it's a two-track thing here. Copyright is designed to protect not only your property, but it's also, the way it's designed, is to protect free speech. And this is the component that's missing. And my solution to it, as I put it in the blog, the solution to copyright is the footnote. You always attribute sources. And this is, when you write companies for permission to cite, this is what they'll essentially tell you. Well, it's fine, just attribute, the source. Well, this is the whole point. What they're doing now is they're insisting on these permission letters, and I talk about the fact that, I've written permission letters, and it's taken months for these companies to respond. And in some cases, they haven't even bothered to do so to this day.
Right.
And what they're going to tell you is, well, footnote.
Right.
So, this whole thing, people, the bottom line here is, I think we're agreed here, the bottom line is people need to take responsibility. Where are they putting their money? Well, I, for one, Catherine, years ago, quit putting my money in big banks because I was noticing they were bouncing my checks, and I knew the money was in there. And I ended up, as part of a class action lawsuit against one of these big banks, now out of business, fortunately, that was literally kiting people's own checks. They were charging late fees with, depositing things late so that they could charge a late fee and make lots of money. And they got caught by a number of people that had noticed the same things happening with their checks bouncing. So I don't even bank with these people because they're not trustworthy.
Right, they aren't trustworthy.
And people need to get back to the local approach to things. Local banks, local doctors, local insurance pools. Yeah, local, local, local.
Right, but look for the excellent people. They're not all excellent.
Exactly. Yeah. Look for excellence.
Some of them are definitely playing for the pro-centralization team. Okay, I want to touch on safety. Everybody knows my popsicle index, which is the percent of people in a neighborhood who believe that a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. And I remember in the 90s people telling me, well, this is really stupid. Nobody worries about safety. And then after 9/11, I had a brilliant Harvard-trained Wall Streeter call me and say, oh, now I understand.
Exactly.
Because they contemplated, oh, they weren't safe. So, my feeling is that most people in America don't feel safe because they aren't safe. And the reality is, safety is a condition precedent to any kind of productivity.
Yes.
So I just felt like I had to deliver a message that says, hey, if I'm not safe, I'm not going to be productive. So, if you want people to be productive, then we have to have the conditions precedent to safety. No more false flags.
No more
among
false
other
flags.
Things.
Right. the thing that we have to understand is that safety and trust and rule of law are the three components that go hand in hand. And the, one of the biggest components of safety is you have to have some sort of implicit agreed upon civilization and culture. You cannot keep importing a completely foreign culture with a completely foreign ideology and expect things to work. This is the other problem that we've been facing.
Or run people for president where they, their death watch lists, how many people are the Clintons going to kill this week?
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Tell me how this is going to make people feel safer. And in addition to this, talk about a point that raises the whole issue of centralization. Are we safe with spending the billions and trillions of dollars on centralized surveillance? Well, we've just had three incidents this last weekend, and I don't care what the media or the government's saying, these were coordinated incidents. And I don't care what the media is saying or the government is saying, the problem underlying it is Islam. You know, I'm going to say it and put it right out there.
Well, do you think the problem is Islam or the problem is the U.S. and other governments financing terrorism?
That too. But when I say that, what I'm trying to point out is it's an ideological problem. In other words, it's there in the tenets of the ideology itself, and we're being told, well, it's not a problem. You know, that's not the problem. Well, it is the problem. And when the government is coming out with just harebrained explanations when people know better, this is contributing to the climate of mistrust. This is why I think it's so very interesting that you have Hillary Clinton, every time you turn around, she's accusing the political opposition of being sexist and racist and homophobes and bigots and black haters and, you know, Islamophobes and every ism and phobia that she can throw out there. And if you look at the reality, who's packing in all of those people in his political rallies? So in other words, the narrative, the old playbooks aren't working, but when they resort to these narratives, what they're doing is they're creating a situation where people can see that they're lying, and therefore do you trust these people at the central level? Well, no, you don't. So trust is breaking down. You can't have safety
without
trust.
But here's the thing, I don't trust Trump either.
I don't either.
If you look at his record,
this is the problem. Sure,
he may be packing him in, but I wonder how much is because you know his backers are using entrainment. So
exactly,
right. And I do think there's.
I don't. Trust
I do think there are a lot of people who feel like, okay, we'll just blow up a negative return on investment system. Trump looks like a guy who'll blow up Washington.
Yeah, I think beyond entrainment and all of that, you know what? What my point is that. Is that the reality is pointing out the hypocrisy of the narrative. And this is the problem, because the hypocrisy of the narrative is there for all to see. It's being pushed in the media. And the only thing that this is going to result in, again, is it's going to collapse the support of the major media. It's already happening. But in the meantime, it creates this climate of mistrust of just about everything. I can't tell you, you know, I'm with you. I mistrust Trump tremendously. And what I hear from people that I deal with on my website is they're in the same boat. They don't trust anybody anymore in government.
Right.
And this is the establishment. This is the reason we have to be extremely careful now with what you said before about the establishment. We need to know who the good people are, what the good concepts are, and need to start promoting them. And we, you know, by the same token, we need to hammer home that there are certain people that you don't want anywhere near government, and you know, Darth Soros being one of them. But but you know, on and
well,
on.
Well, here's the reality. The official reality has gotten so far away from reality that it's unbearable.
Yeah.
And the problem is that we have kept, you know, we have kept all these this critical knowledge and information and technology secret, and that has created an enormous privilege.
Yes.
And that privilege has created a leadership class which is calcifying and of little use at this point. And we need to find a way to steadily reduce that transparency and reduce the privilege, because we can't afford the privilege.
The privilege is killing us. We can't.
The privilege is killing us, and you pointed out that famous economist op-ed piece last July, where you know the British oligarchy basically saying, you know, your political class is completely calcified.
Right.
And you can't expect solutions out of that. So we've created privilege, which you know I thought we fought a revolution over that whole issue. We've got to get rid of this idea that just because you're a big corporation, you're privileged. We've got to get rid of this idea.
About how bad it is that the British are having to come back and complain to us.
Yes, exactly.
About
exactly.
About privilege.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, God, the world, the wheel turns.
It's all upside down. Yeah, it's all upside down.
It's what you said. It's nuts. Okay.
It's nuts.
Improving our own productivity, because there's no way we wait. You know, this has to happen on a decentralized basis.
Yes.
And I think one of the greatest insights of the last 2 years, and we're going to put it on our new coin. We're reissuing our silver coin. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, we're going to have the slogan, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yes.
Because if you're going to recreate and reinvent the covenant globally, it was your insight, you know, then we're going to have to practice the golden rule globally.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
So we can't wait for anybody else. You know, I have to do it in my life. You have to do it in your life. We all have to do it because every person's different. Every place is different. Every, you know, part of the decentralization thing is it's a lot of complexity. So, but you can generalize about something. So let's just walk. I wanted to walk through some of my recommendations for improving productivity. And the one I keep hammering is we have to make our mind our own. And this, yes. Joseph, I think is the most important first step. And I think it's the hardest.
I agree. And it's part of the reason I think people have to wake up to these technologies and techniques of entrainment. I noted in your brochure that you said you advised cutting off all of the access of these entrainment technologies and techniques to your private life. And, you know, I did that a year ago when I moved here. I have cable, but it's not hooked up. I don't watch TV. I don't feed the monster. And if I had an ability to get my internet and phone service without having to pay for cable that I don't use and watch, I'd do it. So this is the other thing that needs to be done. We need to start figuring out how we can force these big companies and show them that we're not buying their media products anymore. And I've gone so far as to write local radio stations and say, you know, I'm not buying anything from this sponsor because they're sponsoring this and that and the other. And, you know, this is what we need to start doing. Turn it off.
Right.
Just get it out of our lives.
It's hard, though, because, you know, I have to be on the internet a fair amount for my work.
I do, too.
And,
I do, too.
But it helps me to really know this stuff exists, and it's as diabolical as it is.
Yeah. I've limited the time that I have to devote to internet. I used to be on my computer every day, but I realized I can do the same thing by scheduling one day a week where I spend on the internet and get rid of all of the stuff as much as possible. Otherwise, it has to be done. But again, you know, it has to be coupled to local action. It has to be coupled to supporting, you know, local banks that you trust. It has to be done in support of your local farmer and so on, as you say. And that, you know, that takes research, but it's worth it in the long run because we've got to quit feeding to the extent that we are able. We've got to quit feeding the monster.
Right. The second thing I find is because there's so much debasement going on and dumbing down, that I have to work very consciously to try and improve my character and habits, because it is so easy to just go with the debasement.
Yep.
It is so easy to allow yourself to become, I don't know, you know, debased along with everybody else. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, skate to where the puck will be. This is from a quote from Wayne Gretzky. Somebody asked him why he was such a good hockey player, and he said, I skate to where the puck will be. I think a lot of people can get hurt by not upgrading their skills and making an effort to migrate to those parts of the world or the economy that are growing. I mean, the industrial economy is dying, And the reality is part of this change is just technology. It's not evildoers doing evil things. It's just the change that's happening in the world. And I think the more we can understand where the world's going and try and adapt, you know, it behooves us to do it because that's where the economic activity is going to be. So, you know, shopping malls are shrinking and spaceports are growing. That's how it is.
Yes, exactly.
So I think taking the time, you know, it was so funny because I've been banging the drum about why private prisons make no sense from a policy or an economic standpoint. It's just kind of a lose.
Yes.
Then a month ago, the Bureau of Prisons cancels the renewals of private prison contracts. The next day, those stocks were down in the first hour, 48%.
Yep.
And I said, hey, you know, if you lost money, that's what you get for being in something that's fundamentally not productive.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so we are watching what I describe as mandated productivity destruction. There's, as I said, 4,000 plus things going on whereby, you know, the pro-centralization team is mandating, for example, vaccines that give kids autism. And the reality is we need to understand, you know, if an autistic child is going to destroy your family and cost $5 million, you know, that's going to take you the rest of your life working to finance, you know, you need to think about that soberly before you insist that your kids get heavy schedules of vaccines. And if that means you have to move from California, whatever state is mandating it, then you have to move.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Right.
Totally. And again, it's a matter of, let's be honest, it's a matter when you advocate that course of action, what you're really saying is we've got to start standing up and just saying no.
Right.
Because these big programs and so on are not working. They are killing productivity. They're killing our children. They're killing our creativity. And enough is enough. And we just have to learn how to say no. And grow a pair, if I can put it bluntly.
Okay, choose your location carefully. I think there are places that are significantly better than others.
Yes.
For many different reasons. I won't go through them all here. And, you know, because you just moved. You just got up and moved.
Yep.
So I think choosing your location and your neighbors carefully. Financial prudence. I just think that now is a time. Risks are increasing steadily, and the expense of those risks are increasing steadily. The shadow work is increasing steadily. That's why I think it behooves you to be extremely prudent in how you manage your financial resources. Be very cautious and be very modest in how you live. You know, this is a time when I used to have, you know, partners worth hundreds of millions of dollars would walk around with sweaters and holes in them.
Yep.
And 15-year-old cars, and, you know, there was a reason.
Yep, exactly.
Do business with the ethical, competent, and productive. This is the hardest thing that I can't seem to get this through to people, Joseph. You know, once upon a time, we knew not to put money in a bank run by shysters.
Right.
And then government guarantees came along, and everybody thought, okay, well, we don't have to worry about that anymore. And we do have to worry about that.
Yes.
You know, I'll never forget one broadcaster complaining that he lost money when MF Global went down. And I thought, you know, this is somebody who's in the alternative news. I thought, what in the world were you doing when John Corzine took over the company? Why didn't you get the hell out?
Yes.
You know, what's wrong with you? So, you know, I just think that you can't afford to associate and do business with people who don't, you know, and any time I get burned, it's because I wasn't tough enough on this issue. I just keep getting tougher and tougher.
Yep, it's absolutely essential. It is absolutely essential. I'm the same way. I have a lot of people that want to associate with me and so on and so forth. And I'm very rigid and rigorous about who I will, and not by associate with, I don't mean just financially. I don't mean just in terms of where I put my money, you know. I mean in terms of actual personal associations. Because there's just a spiritual necessity, really, to wall off every evil and bad influence that you have, and they will seek you out. And at that point, you just have to say no. I'm not allowing it. I'm not allowing it here. I'm not allowing it in my life. I'm not allowing it on my website or whatever. You know, it's something people have to start doing.
Well, the hardest thing for me was when it came to cutting off people in my family.
Yeah,
and,
same here.
You know, I had to learn, look, if you have somebody in your family who pines for the treats of the tapeworm,
yep,
you cannot afford, you know, because they're going to do things that steal your time.
Yep.
And really drain your energy, and you just cannot afford it.
Yeah, time is our most precious commodity, and we have to learn to invest it wisely. And these people, as you say, they drain your energy, they drain your emotions, they drain your, you know, they drain your productivity, and you just have to eventually just cut them off. It's a spiritual principle. It's very, very old. You know, it's excommunication, basically.
Oh, that's going to be one of those ferals for the history books.
You are excommunicated.
Okay, planning. I try very hard to get my clients, in addition to doing financial budgets, to do time budgets.
Right, exactly.
And you and I have talked a lot about shadow work and how everybody's time is being wasted, but that's a huge concern. And you know, it comes down to only associating with people who really give you energy and really valuing your time and investing it wisely. So I would say planning, particularly time budgets, is important. And I think intention in this environment, when things are so complex and, you know, so gridlocked and overwhelming, creating the right intention and then moving towards something energetically is very helpful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And time budgeting is so important, too, for another reason. For busy people, you know, you're busy, I'm busy. If we didn't have a routine, you know, if we didn't have a time budget, you know, we'd get swamped.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are not used to sitting down and saying, well, I need to spend this many hours per day on this project or that project and so on and so forth. It's really simply a matter of discipline. And
right.
You know, it's, again, you know, we're going back to education, because in the modern educational classroom, particularly with Mr. Gates and billionaire busybodies like him trying to interfere with the whole thing, yeah, what you have is you have time that's budgeted on all of this busy work, and nothing really is being produced. You know, this is the latest movement in education. They're finding out that less homework actually helps students learn better.
Right.
So, you know, again, it's budgeting your time. Time is our most precious commodity, and we have to learn to start investing it wisely.
Right, especially because there's so many people in the environment who are going to waste it if you let them.
Exactly, exactly.
And then finally, I have an expression called turtle. Which I came up with during the litigation. And turtle is what you do when everything looks hopeless, and normally you'd quit, but you just say, oh, you know, I'm just going to turtle anyway.
Yep.
And it's amazing how it works. You just shut, you know, I kind of shut off the bigger picture and just power through, and then you wake up the next day, and it's amazing how much you got done. It's really a force multiplier, as the military
would
say.
Well, you've mentioned something very critical here, and I want to emphasize it. And that's basically shutting off the big picture, because what I think is so debilitating, particularly in modern America, and particularly during this election cycle, I view this election as a referendum, not an election. It's a referendum on concepts, not an election of people.
Right.
And the biggest problem that Americans have is they, particularly those involved with the alternative media, is that they're looking at all of this vast corruption and they're thinking, oh, what can I do? And they literally tire themselves out thinking about it.
Right.
Well, what can I do? What can I do to stop the corruption on Wall Street? Well, answer, nothing. But you can address the corruption in your own sphere of action, in your own sphere of influence, in your own life. And that's what people, again, quit focusing on the circus sideshow in Washington, D.C., and start focusing on your local county sheriff or what have you.
Right.
That's where you can fix things. And leave, you know, when you start acting at that level, and quit worrying about the big picture. The big picture will change.
Right. Well, you know the story. About 5 years ago, we had a huge food fight in my county, and we got one of the local police chiefs elected a sheriff and got the sheriff replaced with someone right. who we all really respect and admire. Joseph, it was one of the most gratifying political experiences of my life.
Exactly.
It was great because, you know, it was a tough fight. Oh, my God. Yep. And did the other side get dirty? And,
well, I'm sure.
You know, but the good guys won.
Well, this again is what needs to be done. The
right.
alternative media has been focusing on national and global issues, which is fine. You know, there's a place
right.
for that. But what we have to start doing now, and this is why I think, again, this idea of trying to emphasize local artistic human productivity, and by artistic, I'm including journalism here. You have to start interacting in the alternative media with more local things. You know, start a website if you've got issues in your locality with a county sheriff or a governor that wants to grab guns or what have you. You know, start a website and just start hammering on these people every which way they turn. They need to be hammered on. Because, you know, nothing creates paralysis like paralysis, you know.
Well, the reality is the more people who will start to, you know, here's the thing. If you just take my personal life and you do my, you know, if you look at my spending and the investment of my time.
Right.
If I just remove my support with my time and money of the bad guys and shift that to the good guys.
Yep.
And do you have any idea how many great local bankers there are who are feeling unloved? You know,
yeah,
you just
exactly.
start shifting your deposits to them. You know what they can do with that money?
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. They can start making loans locally. They can start making more money. They can start making more gifts and contributions locally. They can just start rocking and rolling locally.
Yes, exactly.
And, right. So, I mean, it's and everybody says, I'm only one person. It's amazing how when you start to in a financial system that is this leveraged, Joseph, you know, a dollar of deposits can leverage into $100 or $200 of
exactly.
money.
Exactly.
Right.
You
and
know,
so
everybody's so, you know, so tied up with the horrors of fractional reserve banking and so on and so forth. But stop and think about what that means locally. Put
right.
your money into a local bank and the multiplier effect locally is going to be huge and tremendous if
right.
enough people do it.
Right. So it's a matter of building the flow, and the more flow goes local, the more courage everybody's going to have to do the next thing.
Yes, exactly.
So, right. So there's a lot of opportunity. Well, before we finish, I just want to go back. We're going to have lots up on the website when we launch about the Grand Virtual Pipe Organ crowdfund. But this is something I'm very excited in because everybody needs to be part of a conspiracy that's juicy. And I want to tell everybody, you can't blame this one on Joseph. This was something I decided we had to do. And I just want to let everybody know I'm going to do it till it's done. So I told Joseph, I don't know if it's going to take 5 days or 5 years, but it will get done. It's just a question of when.
Well, I want to thank you again for that. I'm absolutely, to use the expression, I'm absolutely gobsmacked. I really am because I've been, no, seriously, because, you know, I grew up, I started playing organs when I was 6 and started playing pipe organs when I was 9.
Uh-huh.
So I grew up with them all through graduate school, and then as a consequence of you know, going over to Oxford and some other personal circumstances, I just lost my contacts in that community and haven't played one in years and years and years.
So
you know,
here's
I've been
what
without, effectively
needs to
without
know.
My music.
So go, if you're interested, go become a member of Giza Death Star and Joseph has a wonderful webinar on organs and organ music, and you can see all the pictures of him when he was a kid in South Dakota. It's very cool in the church with the organ. It's great, you know. It's a great slice of American history. Your story of music in the South Dakota community, anyway. But so you're going to be hearing more about that. But if there's any chance you want to converge with us. You know, because we were trying to figure out, we had people coming from all directions. Okay, where are we going to converge? So we're conversing on Tulsa, Oklahoma on Saturday dinner. October 15th, 7 to 11 p.m. It's going to be one of those events. You know, just like people said, well, you know, I was at Woodstock.
Right.
They're going to say, don't laugh. I was at the Grand Virtual Pipe Organ Crowdfund Launch Party in Tulsa, Oklahoma, October 15th, 2016. I was in the conspiracy.
Well, you know, since we're talking about that, if people want to bring my books and have me to sign, I'm always happy to sign things, too, for people, you know.
Perfect.
I enjoy those get-togethers with people. You know, that's why I like to go to conferences, because it's the conversations you have away from the formal speaking sessions that's where you have the good conversations and things get
right.
done. So.
Well, you know you're going to have to speak. You know you're going to have to speak, right?
About what?
It doesn't matter, you know, because you remember, it's one thing I will say is that you can drink as much wine, you know, wine is part of the ticket price, so.
Well, I'll be happy to answer and field questions, you know, that's why I'm going,
okay.
You know, is to have conversations with people and just talk. So,
okay.
Anything that people want to talk about, we'll talk about.
Okay, well, Joseph, in fact, we're going to be back in a couple of weeks with you to talk about news stories and trends for the third quarter wrap-up, so we can't wait for that because, you know, we didn't have Brexit, but we did have an interesting and bizarro quarter, so we have a lot to talk about.
Yep, absolutely.
Have a great day, Joseph. Thanks.
Yep, thanks for having me back on, Catherine.